This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Special Memphis Police Unit involved in the beating death of Tyre Nichols has now been disbanded. But similar units exist in other American cities. Lawmakers and law enforcement leadership say the units are especially important to suppress crime in victimized neighborhoods. Is that true? Are they effective? And how often are these specialized police units involved in cases of egregious police violence? Well, Seth Stoughton was once a patrolman on the Tallahassee, Florida police force. Today, he's a professor of law and criminology at the University of South Carolina. He has studied the body cam videos of what happened to Tyre Nichols frame by frame.
I was an officer for about 5 years. I made or assisted with literally hundreds of arrests, used force on a number of occasions against individuals who were trying to get away or otherwise. And I never saw anything like this from my colleagues.
Stoughton describes some of what shocked him most as a former police officer.
Over the course of the encounter, you see officers striking Mr. Nichols about the head and face with closed fists while he's on the ground. You see them apparently holding Mr. Nichols while another officer strikes him in the head with what is at least at times a closed fist. You see officers holding Mr. Nichols on the ground while another officer kicks him. You see officers using baton, taser, and pepper spray.
The officers had also pulled Nichols out of the car, an action Stoughton says is an overt violation of standard policing procedure, especially in light of the fact that Stoughton sees no indication in the video that the officers ever thought Tyre Nichols posed a threat.
There are a couple of specific things that suggest that it would be a real stretch for officers to say that they were afraid that Mr. Nichols was going to hurt them. Early on in the videos, you see an officer opening his driver's side door and physically reaching in and pulling Mr. Nichols out. That's a really bad idea on a pure tactical level. For an officer to reach into a car like that, they're not worried about that individual grabbing him and driving away.
In addition, Stoughton points out a series of important facts that the world has now seen in the video. Tyre Nichols was doing everything he could to comply with the flurry of contradictory orders hurled at him by the officers.
You never see him try and strike, push, kick, shove, bite any of the officers. You never see him reach for any of the officers' weapons, and they don't say anything about him doing that during the actual use of force incident itself. When officers get Mr. Nichols handcuffed, most of them stand up and walk away from him. He's not kept under close guard at that point, indicating that officers are really not too worried about him. When officers are talking after the use of force, they're not talking about how close they came to losing the fight with Mr. Nichols. They're not expressing any indication that they were threatened by Mr. Nichols.
So why does Stoughton think it's important to note that the police officers felt they were not in danger?
I think this is something to keep an eye on, because I think in their legal filings, in the ultimate civil or criminal charges, the officers are going to claim that Mr. Nichols was fighting with them, that he was a threat, that he was attacking them. I didn't see anything in the video to support that.
That was Seth Stoughton, a former officer on the Tallahassee Police Force and now a professor of law and criminology at the University of South Carolina. Well, let's turn now to Brenda Goss Andrews. She's president of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Executives and president of the retired Detroit Police Members Association. She served for more than 30 years on the Detroit Police Force, first as a beat cop, and she retired as deputy chief. Brenda Goss Andrews, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, and hello.
So first of all, I'd just like to hear from you, from your experience as a police officer, react to what you saw in the videos that were released about Mr. Nichols' beating.
Well, first I'd like to say anyone that saw this video anywhere in the world would say that this was egregious and horrific and unnecessary and needless behavior by a group of rogue police officers. So my reaction is like the reaction of anyone, whether you're a police officer or a citizen, that this was horrific and it did not need to happen.
Yeah, you are president of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Executives. I wonder how this latest incident is going over with your fellow black law enforcement officers.
Well, like I said earlier, we are all horrified. I've talked to several, and I do represent the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. We have close to 4,000 members and chapters all over the country, comprising federal, state, local, county police officers. And you will not find, I doubt, any police officer that would say that this was acceptable. This is not good police work. And this does not represent the majority of police throughout this country. And the majority of police officers are good. They are trustworthy. This behavior is an anomaly. It's unfortunate. We certainly bring condolences to the Nichols and Wells family, who will be burying their loved one today. And this just should not have happened. It should never happen.
Mm. The officers who've been charged with Tyree Nichols' death are black. So is there something, I mean, I hear what you're saying about the majority of police officers not being like this, but is there something fundamentally gone wrong then with these specialized units? Because many people are asking questions about, they're considered to be more elite, perhaps have less oversight and accountability, that makes it harder to be sure that, to use your words, that officers don't go rogue.
Well, I'm going to go back a little bit. Specialized units, for lack of a better word, have been around for decades. There were specialized units when I first came on as a police officer. I'm going to think that there were even before that. Detroit, if I may, had what we call STRESS, Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets. And that was probably formulated in the early 70s, maybe late 60s into the early 70s, to do just that. It was a rash of robberies. Community was in an uprage with the police department, do something, do something. So they had this unit. And then after a while, they were accused of, beating citizens, doing some unlawful things. Well, Coleman Young, which is the first African-American mayor in Detroit, said that he needed to abolish STRESS. It was no longer doing what it was designed to do. And he also came on at a time when he wanted to diversify the police department with African-Americans and females, being that Detroit was probably about 83% to 85% African-American. However, the police department did not reflect that. So this is when STRESS came about. So he actually disbanded the STRESS unit. But that did not mean that other units came about, which Detroit, every city, or especially every major city and probably others, have some type of units that target specific things. Police officers on patrol, they're responding to calls for service. That's all they're doing, just going to that call for service, taking care of that, and then going back in service. They do not have the opportunity to just go into a community, target some things, whether it's robberies, home invasions. It could be any number of things. And that's how these specialized units come about, usually because of the outcry from the community or outcry from the business community a lot of times. And so they choose officers to go in and supervisors to go in. Their mission is to investigate or to stop or do something about that particular crime. So I would say they are, effective if they stay on point and stay on mission.
Mm, okay. So, in fact, we're going to talk more about specifically what happened with that Detroit STRESS unit that you mentioned, President Gus Andrews. in a few minutes, because you're exactly right. I mean, that's why we want to we're having this discussion, to really understand in as much detail as possible the origin and then behavior of these other units in cities across the country. But I have to ask you, you know, many people are saying that it doesn't actually matter that the officers involved in Tyree Nichols' death were Black. What matters is that Tyree Nichols was Black, and that this is just yet another example of institutionalized racism in America's police force, you know, laid bare on another city street. I wonder what your response is to that, President Gus Andrews.
Well, my thoughts is that Tyree Nichols was Black, but Tyree Nichols was a human being, and his life mattered. His race, yes, we know that, but the key for me is that this is a human being, and we kind of get away from that when we look through, you know, the lens and the aperture of race and ethnicity, when we should first look at this is a person, this is a human being, this is someone's loved one. The same, conversely, with the officers. The officers were Black, yes, but these were officers that were inhumane. They did not value, you know, human life. So then we can look at some of the, you know, the other things, but let's not lose sight that this was a human being lost his life.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And at the same time, I would also say that it's impossible to not ask the question about race, especially given the history of this country. But what we're going to do is, when we come back, we're going to talk more again about the nationwide use of these specialized police units. So that'll be in a moment. President Brenda Goss Andrews, stand by. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about specialized police units like the now disbanded Scorpion Unit in Memphis, Tennessee. This unit involved in the police beating death of Tyree Nichols. And we're talking about why these units exist in cities across the country, what they're intended to do, and whether or not they are effective. Now, when the Scorpion Unit was formed in November of 2021, Memphis's Assistant Police Chief Sean Jones told local reporters that the unit was created to tackle a rising crime wave.
It's important to us that each member of the community feels like they can go to the grocery store or live in their house without their house being shot or shootings currently or frequently occurring on the streets and on the roadways. So for that reason, we launched the Scorpion Unit.
Then, several months later, in January of 2022, in the State of the City speech, Memphis Mayor Jim Strickland proudly described the Scorpion Unit as a success story for the city.
This unit addresses violent crimes such as homicides, aggravated assaults, robberies, and carjackings that occur throughout our city. Since its inception in this past October, through 3 days ago, the Scorpion Unit has had a total of 566 arrests, 390 of them for felonies. They have seized $103,000 in cash, 270 vehicles, and 253 weapons.
That was January of 2022. Now, Memphis Police Chief C.J. Davis spoke on CNN last Friday and defended the creation of the Scorpion Unit, even though she has now disbanded it. She described its core mission.
reduce gun violence, be visible in communities, and to also impact the rise in the crime, basically out of an outcry from the community. We had record numbers in 2021, 346 homicides. So this unit was put together, and they had great success, believe it or not. Last year was the first year in a long time that we had reductions.
So, but is this an indication of a failure in that unit?
This is an indication that there is a gap somewhere in that unit.
Well, I'm joined today by Brenda Goss Andrews. She served for more than 30 years on the Detroit Police Force, retired as deputy chief. She's currently president of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Executives. I'd like to bring Radley Balco into the conversation now. He's a journalist and author who's written a number of books about American policing, including Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces, and Overkill, The Rise of Paramilitary Police Raids in America. Radley Balco, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, how would you describe what the core mission of these specialized or elite police units are in the cities that they've been created in?
Well, I think that's part of the problem is that their mission, their mandate tends to be pretty vague. It tends to be crime suppression. And, you know, that can include any number of crimes. They're also... You know, as we saw with this unit, they're given, you know, pretty extraordinary authority to, for example, conduct pretextual traffic stops for the purpose of, you know, generating leads in, you know, more serious cases. You know, I'm not against police specialization. I think it's good to have officers who are particularly trained to investigate and prevent certain types of crimes, but these kind of vague crime suppression units have a long and sordid history. You know, I believe in the previous segment, the stress units in Detroit were mentioned. I mean, those units did a lot to undermine trust between police and the community in Detroit. But we've seen similar scandals all over the country. You had the crash units in Los Angeles that created the Rampart scandal in the early 2000s. You've had the street crimes and plainclothes units in New York City that were responsible for the deaths of people like Amadou Diallo and Sean Bell and some of the more, Eric Garner, some of the more, you know, well-known police fatalities of police custody in that city's history. Chicago has had a really long and sordid history of these units, including units that were brought down because of officers who, you know, not just police abuse, not just corruption, but officers dealing drugs, officers... you know, planting evidence, planting guns on people they'd shot. In one case, one of the officers who was cooperating with federal investigators, the head of the unit, it was called the SOS unit, took out a hit on that officer. And then most recently in Baltimore, we had the Elite Gun Crimes Unit, which was brought down in a really just awful scandal. I believe 7 or 8 officers ended up going to prison for a wide range of criminal activity, including pretty much everything I just mentioned. So, you know, I think, you know, I understand why police officials and particularly politicians, when there's a rise in crime, they want to show that, you know, they get it, that they understand the public's frustration. And creating these units is a intuitive way to do that, right? We need to give police officers more leeway. We need to give them less supervision. We need to let them sort of do what they have to do to solve crime in our city. But in the end, you know, one of the fundamental things you need to effectively keep the community safe is the trust of the community. If people don't trust the police, they don't call them when something goes wrong. They don't cooperate when the police ask questions during an investigation. And, you know, fundamentally, you know, an incident like Tyre Nichols just does incalculable damage to the trust in these communities.
Yeah. So I want to dig into more of the details that you just laid out here. And again, let's go back to that stress unit in Detroit in the 1970s, because as Brenda Goss Andrews correctly said, it was called the Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets unit or stress unit. And President Goss Andrews, Radley Balco has reported, you know, specifically that the reason why that stress unit, you know, one of the earliest examples of one of these specialized police groups, the reason why it was disbanded is because they were accused of planting evidence, physical abuse, corruption. They killed as many as 24 people, almost all of them black. And then the city ended the program, according to Radley's reporting after the unit raided an apartment where five Wayne County Sheriff's deputies, were all black, were playing poker. There was a shootout that left a deputy dead. So it wasn't, these are not sort of minor infractions that called for the reform of a unit, but rather even in the 1970s, it was decided that the only effective thing to do was to end the unit. So President Gus Andrews, I'm just wondering, is there a problem then with the fundamental mission and perhaps lack of oversight it seems like these units have?
Well, I think, you know, the mission is, there's nothing wrong with the mission. And I think we've all mentioned that these units operate throughout the country. Yes, there's been historically issues with them. There's been issues with, you know, police officers, just patrol. You know, we hear about these stories of brutality. So that goes on. But the issue here is accountability and oversight. Whether it's a specialized unit, whether it's an actual police, you know, force. So I don't agree with the fact of just having a specialized unit and just giving them carte blanche on the community. There must be accountability, and there must be oversight, and there must be leadership. When looking at the body cam footage, what I didn't see, and maybe it'll bear out that a supervisor was there, but that would not make it good either if a supervisor was there and did take over that scene and stop what was going on. But they're going to have to look at the level of supervision. I think it goes to who are we putting in these units? Mm-hmm. How are we vetting those that are going into the unit? Are we looking at, you know, their past performance? Are we looking at, you know, their career? How long have they been in policing? You know, I think it's a matter of those kinds of things, not the mission of what it's for, because the community still wants, you know, the police to come in and deal with some of these things in the community. And every community is different in terms of demographic. What might work in Detroit might not work in Florida, you know, and all over. Yeah. We understand that.
Yeah.
But the key is right now is oversight and supervision, close supervision, making sure that the units are staying true to the mission. And those that are not, then they need to be removed from the unit. I think that's where we're going wrong. We just put them out there and, you know, hope that they bring in, you know, the guns and make the arrests and all of that. So I think right now that's the key, oversight and accountability.
Okay.
I think the community, you know, will be satisfied to know that police were doing more in terms of overseeing these units.
Yes. So Radley Balco, let's talk about these two main points. First of all, Brenda Goss Andrews brought up who's on these units. I keep referring to them as elite. Are they?
Well, I mean, it kind of depends on what you mean by elite. You know, I had I mentioned this in the piece I wrote on this for the New York Times, but I've interviewed a lot of retired police officers over the years. And, you know, one thing you hear over and over from them is that a lot of them were there when SWAT teams were first introduced to their department. And they would say, you know, that the officers who really, really wanted to be on the SWAT team were the last officers you should put on the SWAT team. And, you know, I think when you call your unit, one of these specialized units, you give it a name like Scorpion, I think it does two things. One is it makes this a unit that's going to be feared in the community, right? Otherwise, why call it Scorpion? And two, it attracts officers who want to be feared because those are the officers who want to work on a unit called Scorpion. And I think that, you know, the fact that it was called this, you know, from the start sort of indicates that, you know, you're appealing to kind of the wrong characteristics that we want in police officers who would, you know, ideally serve on a sort of idealized version of one of these units. And we see this in police culture with these units a lot. In New York, with the plainclothes units, they were known to wear a shirt that had a quote on the back from Hemingway about the joys and pleasures of hunting men. You know, a lot of these units have patches, you know, these official police patches or challenge coins that include, you know, images of the Grim Reaper or skulls and crossbones. So, you know, I think that ideally, yes, you would attract the elite officers, both not in terms of their sort of use of force skills or investigative skills, but also the elite in terms of their temperament and their ability to interact with the community in a sort of productive way. But unfortunately, I think the way that these units are designed and the way they recruit and the way they just sort of, the officers they generally appeal to, you're attracting officers who, don't necessarily demonstrate those characteristics.
You know, I'm also seeing that there are reports that the amount of training, which one would think would be a higher level of training for a unit with a, you know, specialized function, right, if we're talking about crime suppression and working in specific neighborhoods and trying to reduce the amount of particular violent crimes, perhaps that would need more training. But a former Memphis police officer has told CBS News, for example, that the unit's training consisted of 3 days of PowerPoint presentations, 1 day of suspect apprehension training, and 1 day at the firing range. So that was it. And Brenda Goss Andrews, is that kind of a standard procedure for officer training for specialized types of units, or does that seem unusually narrow to you?
Well, I think, and I don't really want to speak to, because I'm sure there's different things for every city, every police department. It's not, the training that they probably receive is not what we would see a SWAT unit. At least I know in Detroit, is very, very selective, very extensive training that went on, you know, for a long period of time. Even when they got to the unit, training was ongoing. So it took a long time for those that were in the SWAT unit, first of all, to get there because it was a very extensive vetting process. These specialized units are unlike, you know, SWAT. They usually brought in, like I said, for specific things. I can't speak to the type of training that they might have, but I can say that that's an aspect not only of vetting who comes in, but also looking at the type of training. What training has the officer already had? What training do we need to have to give them? But also, I don't want us to think about the fact that usually they're trying to get a unit maybe up and running quickly. I'm not saying that that's the right way, but you've got the business community on you. You've got the community on you. This is happening. This is happening. Calls for service is not going to take care of the problem. So I think administrators are saying, what can we do? What can we do, you know, quickly? So it's not a easy solution. Is it one we need to look at? Absolutely. And I go back to what I was saying, you know, vetting the proper officers, having the right supervision, accountability, all of those have to become part, you know, of it. Now, whether 3 days of training is enough or 5 days or 10 days or more, you know, I don't know. I think that would vary from department to department and community to community.
Brenda Goss Andrews, let me just jump in here. I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I'm just running out of time in this segment, and I've got to let you just go in a couple of minutes, but I want to ask you one more quick question. I hear your point about, you know, needing training, needing accountability. I think that, in fact, Radley Balco, I would guess, Radley, you'd be in agreement with her on that. But we're also talking about a pattern of sort of misbehavior, to put it lightly, that Radley has outlined, that's been going on for decades. So what do you, Brenda, what do you think has, we have got a minute before the break here, what do you think has stopped the accountability from already being, you know, put in place if we've known that there's potentially a problem for such a long time?
Well, I think, and probably this is a discussion for another time, but when you look at policing being a male-dominated profession, it always has been, it still is. But I think your other guest mentioned it, and what I refer to as the hyper-masculinity culture of the police department that brings these people on because they want to be aggressive. You know, they want to be that, you know, macho, you know, kind of person. So they gravitate towards maybe being on these units, but that's the culture of policing. How do we change that, or how do we modify that? That's another discussion. But I think that's one of the things, the culture and the subculture of policing is hyper-masculine.
Mm. Well, Brenda Goss Andrews served more than 30 years on the Detroit Police Force, retired as deputy chief. She's president of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Executives and president of the Retired Detroit Police Members Association. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Radley Balco, hang in here for just a minute. We're going to talk a little bit more after the break about things that we can possibly do to reform or improve or bring that accountability that we've been talking about to these specialized police units in cities across the country. That's when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Radley Balco joins us today. He's an author of the newsletter on Substack called The Watch. He's reported for years on policing in America, author of the book Rise of the Warrior Cop. And he recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times titled Tyree Nichols' Death Proves Yet Again That Elite Police Units Are a Disaster. And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. And it's those elite police units around the country that we are talking about today. And as Radley had mentioned earlier, there is quite a chain of incidents of egregious violence amongst these police units from city to city. He mentioned New York City. Well, New York disbanded its special anti-crime unit in 2020. Here was then Mayor Bill de Blasio on local news channel NY1 saying the plainclothes unit wasn't effective and that, in fact, the NYPD had more success after the unit was shut down.
Commissioner Shea made the decision to disband that unit. And he made it because he felt that there were not the best outcomes from it coming from that approach in terms of fighting crime. And it was not helping in terms of drawing communities closer to the NYPD, which is the ultimate way you fight crime, when community and police are really unified. Since then, gun arrests have gone up intensely, which I think proves the commissioner was right.
So that was then-Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York. Well, the city's current mayor, Eric Adams, has reestablished the unit, but he told CNN this time it's different.
When I put back in place our anti-gun unit, many people stated that we should not do it, but we were able to remove 7,000 guns off our streets. That's a 27-year high. And when you look at the number of arrests for those who carry guns, we must have proper training, proper mindset, and the police officers across our country must have the right mindset to do this very difficult and challenging job of public protection.
That's New York City's current mayor, Eric Adams. Well, I'm joined now by Brianna Fox. She's a professor of criminology at the University of South Florida. She's also a former FBI agent. She consults with police departments around the country and studied Tampa's Violent Crimes Bureau. And she joins us from St. Petersburg. Professor Fox, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, the reason why I wanted to play that, you know, that de Blasio and Adams tape back to back is because you hear almost two what feels like diametrically opposed purposes for these specialized units. I mean, you heard de Blasio talking about the need to fundamentally build trust in a community as the most effective form of fighting crime. And then Eric Adams comes in a couple of years later and points to the statistics about guns seized, et cetera. Are these two missions, these two purposes, mutually exclusive in the way that or given the way that these specialized units are typically, you know, formed and what their missions are.
That is such a great point, and I would argue absolutely not. We should be reducing crime and building trust with the community. And a lot of people say those are diametrically opposed, and the way that we are suppressing crime and trying to reduce crime by a lot of police departments across the country is actually fostering this distrust in police. And that actually could be true, but there is a way to do both that's extremely effective.
Well, so I wonder how that's possible, especially given the fact that it seems as if these units, as Radley said, their mandates are somewhat vague with this term of crime suppression, right? And you heard President Goss Andrews say earlier that then laid in with the hyper-masculine culture of many police departments leads to the kinds of behavior that other people in Memphis experienced at the hands of the Scorpion Unit. I mean, just days before Tyre Nichols was beaten, Memphis resident Cornell McKinney was stopped by officers in that same unit as he was picking up pizza, and he described what happened.
All I hear is, freeze, get out the car. Put your hands up before I blow your heads off. Both of you, get out the car. So put your hands up. So I put my hands up, and one of the officers proceeded to come to the car, and he physically pulled me out by my shoulder with a gun no more than a foot away from my head.
Now, in the end, Cornell McKinney said the officers said they were just kidding. And he filed a complaint with the city but didn't hear back. So, Brianna Fox, respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely inappropriate behavior, and that has no place in policing, especially if we're trying to maximize the impact of, you know, law enforcement. There's a lot of research that shows, you know, a small proportion of all people that commit crimes are responsible for the vast majority of offenses in our neighborhoods. And when you're, you know, going out and essentially harassing citizens, they feel both over-policed and under police at the same time. They feel like, why are you stopping me for this nonsensical reason when I know there's serious crimes happening out there and you're not solving them or preventing them? So this is, again, antithetical to that goal of trying to build trust with our community. And it's also not preventing or solving any crimes either.
Mm. Radley Belko, would love to get your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. I think building trust, I mean, I think these units are sort of antithetical to building trust because the very characteristics of them that I think make them appealing to politicians who want to show that they're taking crime seriously and they're getting tough on crime, you know, the whole idea is that traditional policing isn't working. So we have to create these units and give them sort of special powers or special authority, or sort of, you know, we're going to fill them with officers who, you know, are known to sort of bend the rules. And, you know, that's what we've seen in department after department across the country. I suppose I'm open to the possibility that there could be ways to do it correctly. But, you know, it has to be done in a way that where there's a lot of oversight, where, you know, you're choosing officers not just on their, you know, marksmanship or their, you know, brawn or their ability to, you know, their talent for investigation, but also for their temperament, for their de-escalation skills, for their negotiation, for their ability to sort of interact with people on a very personal level. You know, perhaps there are police departments across the country where that is happening, but, you know, the largest departments in the country that have tried these units, that, you know, doesn't appear to be what happened.
Mm. Radley, can you just give me a little bit more detail here? Because we've talked perhaps too vaguely about the special authority that some of these units might have. What are they allowed to do that ostensibly, you know, regular beat cops wouldn't be allowed to do?
Well, I think it depends. It varies from city to city. And a lot of times we don't know the extent of, I mean, sometimes a special authority can just amount to less supervision and less oversight, which, you know, allows them to get away with more. But certainly, you know, the ability to make pretextual traffic stops for the ability of so that they can investigate, you know, or generate leads for more serious crimes, I think would be a type of special authority. But also, I mean, if you look what happened in Memphis, right? I mean, First of all, the very existence of that video suggests to me that those officers, I mean, they knew that they were on video. And still, we saw what happened in that footage. So that suggests to me that they knew that there wasn't going to be a lot of supervision, or that up until that point, there hadn't been a lot of supervision or oversight of that unit. Then you look at the fact that somebody tried to, you know, file a complaint with some pretty serious allegations a few days earlier, and, you know, never heard back from the department. So that suggests that, you know, there certainly isn't any oversight or supervision in terms of taking citizen complaints seriously. And I think it was the local NPR affiliate in Memphis also reported, you know, talking to several other people who said they had similar problems with this unit, everything from these really violent, sort of aggressive pretextual traffic stops to, you know, officers kicking down doors to homes, you know, to serve drug warrants, you know, and getting the wrong house, or in some cases not even having a warrant. So clearly, you know, I don't think the added authority is always going to be particularly explicit. It's going to be more in terms of not enforcing the rules that are already there.
Okay. So, Brianna Fox, and let's sort of get technical here, right? Because it doesn't seem like cities are in any time in the near future are going to fully let go of units with, you know, these different mandates. But so what about, Radley mentioned these pretextual stops. I wonder, that's still kind of a, you know, a sledgehammer approach when what's really needed is a scalpel, if I can put it that way, because you point to research that shows that 80% of violent crimes in particularly victimized neighborhoods are committed by a small fraction of people who aren't getting arrested, what, 6% of folks in those neighborhoods. So maybe pretextual stops should end, and the units should be, you know, trained to do something entirely different.
I would absolutely agree with that. And that's exactly what we did in Tampa. And we've actually since expanded this to different departments across the country. Specifically, we said that there is a small group of people that are serial trigger pullers. These are the ones that repeatedly are committing this gun violence. And it's evidenced not by them, you know, having a gun on their person when they're in their car. That's not a strong predictor of going ahead and committing another serious gun crime. It's the fact that they've committed serious gun crimes in the past. And, you know, the officers that are working in that unit know this. They're not pulling people over for, you know, random stops and looking for a random gun in their glove compartment. What they're really doing is saying, you know, the people that are most likely to be committing these violent crimes, they have a history of doing so. And until basically those people are either deterred, or what they've actually been doing in Tampa, and we just got a DOJ grant to initiate here, is offering them social services. Nobody decides, I just want to become a gun offender and start, you know, and live this life and then end up in prison. If there's something that's going on in their lives that lead them to do this, either social services could be offered, the police can offer support, the community can help intervene. We're really using a multifaceted approach, which I think is one of the fundamental differences that we're seeing between these specialized units and what actually works. There's no silver bullet. And the more people that you have in coalition trying to address the most serious violent offenders, that's what actually works. The way that it's been done matters just as much as, you know, the fact that there's a name on the masthead saying a specialized unit.
Okay, so Radley Balko, you know, as Professor Fox is saying, there's a big gap between what we know actually works and the mandates of these specialized units. And yet, as you've reported, cities keep, you know, even after they've disbanded them, reconvening the units. So why are lawmakers doing this?
I think because it's easy. I mean, it's a very easy way to show that you're tough on crime. It's something that intuitively makes sense to a lot of people if they're not familiar with how these stories usually play out. But, you know, I want to agree with a lot of what Brianna was saying. You know, I think there's a history of in New York, for example, you know, New York's had its own problems with these units. But New York also in the 80s and 90s took a very kind of interventionist social work approach to gang activity. And in contrast to places like Los Angeles and Chicago, which took a very aggressive, confrontational sort of, you know, specialized forces or special unit, special anti-gang unit approach. And, it was much more successful in New York. And I think it's one of the sort of unheralded reasons why crime dropped so precipitously over New York starting about the mid-1990s, more than it did across the rest of the country. So, you know, I do think that there are, you know, I don't think this is hopeless. I do think there are good solutions out there. Violence interruption groups, a lot of these nonprofits that work either with or independently of police agencies to attack, or attack isn't the right word, intervene in these sort of, you know, gang disputes or just sort of neighborhood beefs. You know, a lot of these killings and murders that we've seen over the last couple of years with the rise in homicide have been retaliatory. And if you can get somebody in there who knows, you know, knows the neighborhood, knows the parties involved and can work on dispute resolution and try to head these this violence off, you know, before it escalates. That's a good record of success where it's been tried around the country, including in Baltimore most recently. There's a good study on that.
So I'm trying to kind of suss out here a chain of causality, if I can describe it that way. So we have, you know, Radley, you really painted a clear picture of a long-term, decades-long series of, you know, egregious events that have happened within these elite police units. So all these acts of violence and death against people, corruption. And, you know, we're describing a process in which that's happening in part because, you know, it seems like there's no or inadequate accountability for the officers of these units. Well, that lack of accountability exists because perhaps there's just no effective system in place for that kind of oversight. But then, of course, you have to ask, why is there no effective system in place for that oversight? And it brings me back to what Brenda Goss Andrews said about the fundamental culture. She's a 30-year veteran of the Detroit police force, and she describes the fundamental culture as hyper-masculine. So, Breonna Fox, in Tampa, where you did that work, was there also a culture change that needed to take place in the Tampa Police Department? Or, you know, how do we get to root causes here?
I think one thing that we've seen consistently in the research is there's a warrior or a guardian mentality. And when you shift to the guardian mentality and really measuring success by crime prevention, not through arrests and crackdowns and, you know, this more, you know, brutal type of measures, that's when, you know, the police department is seeing, wow, we're really getting a bang for our buck out of what we're doing here. And, you know, in Tampa, they were putting more effort into, you know, these bigger investigations, multi-agency with, you know, the FBI, with local partners. They brought me on board, an academic researcher. There was, you know, this community engagement. That was the most successful way to addressing, you know, violent crime. And what I think was really important is while we saw a dramatic decrease in both violent crime and gun crime in Tampa, we also saw a massive decrease in the overall number of arrests. And police, when you explain to them, you know, when you don't have to make as many arrests, you can work smarter. You don't have to police in this way. They at the end of the day, the proof is in the pudding, and they really like those results. Mm-hmm. So when we started, you know, implementing that and they saw how effective it could be, I think that there didn't have to be, you know, an outsider telling them, you need to change your culture. I think the culture changed itself because they saw how successful it was.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we have to wrap up today's conversation. Breonna Fox, professor of criminology at the University of South Florida and a former FBI agent as well, thank you so much for joining us. And Radley Balco, author of Rise of the Warrior Cop and Overkill and author of the Substack newsletter called The Watch. Radley, thank you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.